Sweetheart, if you board that plane without making a donation to WBAI, one of these days you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon, and for the rest of your life. WBAI is the only station with the guts and determination to seriously challenge this nightmare Trump. The rest of the media are cowards. It's the voice of the poor, oppressed, downtrodden, and the imprisoned. You know, Rick, this fella Trump is bad news. He's worse than Major Strasser. Act occasionally. Why don't you make a donation? I already did at give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. Louis, I think this the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Hey Maya, guess what? Kylie Jenner's new lip kit is out.
Mercedes, are you really gonna spend your money on that garbage?
It's not garbage. She finally released a color I've been looking for, ginger.
Mercedes, you can do so much more.
Like what?
You can donate it to WBAI and become a BAI buddy.
What's a BAI buddy?
A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a monthly donation to WBAI. Once you join, you'll receive a BAI buddy card and a free token. You can sign up at WB.
Assuming we can get this console to work, good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program. I'm still almost always a Saturday. A weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, an interview with David Gerwig recorded last week. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. It'd be, I think, very easy to look at the new film, The Discovery, and think that Netflix, where the film is running, saw The Arrival and said, ooh, we gotta get a piece of that introspective sci-fi stuff, and then whomped up this in response. I don't think that really happened. The release dates are too close together for one thing, and I don't think Netflix plays that kind of game, although maybe this came in as a film that was already in existence, and Netflix saw it as an easy way to tap into that market. I don't know for sure.
We are recording, but before we begin, I will explain that this is not just the, obviously, GOH speech, but this is also a radio.
Okay, I beg your pardon, but I don't know what I did. This one was, I think, human error, where we moved from one thing to another. Aha, okay. I pulled a flash drive out. Aha. And I thought I was playing Dan's movie review from that from the flash drive. Darn it. No, I didn't. I bleeped up. I
what's the number?
I number threed up. I threed up, for those who are familiar with the alleged seven words, which have nothing to do with the FCC. The third word. I threed up, and it really twos me off.
So, I apologize. The problem with the volume levels, that was not me. That was somebody threeing our console here. But cutting off Dan Persons there, that was totally my fault and error. And I am going to start that review from the beginning. So that you can follow the flow, follow the discovery
of working in radio,
and I have still not yet earned $100.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. It'd be, I think, very easy to look at the new film, The Discovery, and think that Netflix, where the film is running, saw The Arrival and said, ooh, we gotta get a piece of that introspective sci-fi stuff, and then whomped up this in response. I don't think that really happened. The release dates are too close together for one thing, and I don't think Netflix plays that kind of game, although maybe this came in as a film that was already in existence, and Netflix saw it as an easy way to tap into that market. I don't know for sure. At the very least, you can see the two films as spiritual cousins, which makes for some interesting contrasts. The Arrival, about a group of linguists trying to communicate with an alien species, was based on an actual SF novella and paid respect to the scientific process and the people who worked within it.
Okay, this time I'm pausing it because I think this time for sure Dan said The Arrival. Name of the movie, for the record, is Arrival. There is no what's the word? There's no article before that, just like my show is Hour of the Wolf and not The Hour of the Wolf. Also named, by the way, after a movie.
The Discovery, written by its director Charlie McDowell and his collaborator Justin Leder, about a scientist played by Robert Redford who discovers proof of an afterlife, or at least that something escapes a dying body and goes elsewhere, is a little dodgier in its premise and the repercussions thereof. No specific science or scientific-sounding double talk is cited, which would be okay, I can roll with that, but what tests my credibility is that the film suggests that, in reaction, people start offing themselves in great, whopping numbers in the hopes of moving on to something better. Now, after the results of the 2016 election, I've had to revise my estimation of the depth of human stupidity. But even after that, I can't envision, even with the presumably ironclad scientific proof that the discovery suggests has been revealed, that humanity would be inclined to begin a great lemming-like leap over the precipice. Maybe I'm too optimistic. In the hands of an Ionesco or the Firesign Theater, which actually did something like this in their album Everything You Know Is Wrong, this would be the setting for some brutal farce. But McDowell has settled on a tone of quiet melancholy, as if this sort of behavior is worthy of bittersweet empathy on our part. The actual story is about the son of the scientist, played by Jason Segel, who rescues a woman, played by Rooney Mara, attempting to transition, and then brings her to join his father on an isolated estate as he and a small group of acolytes attempt to develop a technology to reveal where all those disembodied spirits are going. This in many ways feels like one of Wim Wenders' forays into genre, more about the personalities, particularly the budding romance between Segel and Mara, than the premise, especially as the story takes a more metaphysical turn toward the end, and a key revelation is dropped about why Segel's character has decided to reunite with his father at this particular moment in time. There's some nice stuff in that twist, even though I figured out what the film's afterlife actually is near the start of the film. And it would have more power if the Discovery's world was more in line with something that reflected actual human behavior. As it is, the film is an emotional journey that falters on a number of false steps. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Okay, thank you, Dan. Talking here with Matt of WBAI about various things. Life, the universe, and everything. And sort of... losing track. Most of this program is pre-recorded. The main segment, which is about to come, runs an hour and 32 minutes, and I'm going to have to pay attention to that because there are naughty words. Now, we are within what is called safe harbor, and we are, in fact, allowed to use such language in an artistic context. But this is not that. This is actually just in the course of a conversation. And under a proper understanding of FCC rules and regulations, which, by the way, are always cited as being law, they are not. They are rules and regulations by which you hold a license in the public trust. The FCC is not a legal. They don't make laws. They have rules. And they can say, well, we can take away your license. You see? It's a different thing. Well, there are driving laws with licenses and like that. But anyway, that's all pedantic. Doesn't matter. What matters is that I know when I can say boo, and when not. If it were in the course of a short story, it's perfectly all right for somebody to say, boy, did I number three up. Only say the word instead of number three. But I can't go on the air during safe harbor between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. and say, I think that this is number three'd up. That's cavalier. That's just using the word for the sake of using the word. Even if it makes a statement stronger, it's cavalier. There's no need to do it. But in the case of a short story, for example, where a character in the short story says that, you are diminishing the power of the art if you do not use that word. However, you may not do so at a time when young children may be listening. That is what the Carlin decision was all about. I don't think we have too many people broadcasting here. Our lawyer knows this. I've studied what he said a great deal, and he's got it exactly right. But for some reason, the manglement of not necessarily the present management, but over the years, some of the management of Pacifica Radio have not understood this. What they know is that we went to the Supreme Court in 1977 and technically lost. How much did it cost us? Not a lot. Millions of dollars are often cited. The actual penalty that we paid was a slap on the wrist. It was minor, really. I mean, it was really minor. The fee from our lawyers and running a Supreme Court case, that's something else. If only we had paid. But we didn't have the money. The lawyers, as a result of running the case, are now one of the top firms in First Amendment law. And as I understand it, I'm not going to swear this is true, but as I understand it, a lot of the debt was forgiven. But it is true that if Pacifica were hit with a really nasty lawsuit, and we are once again at a time when we have to be very careful, don't know if they would have the money to fight. And so I respect the rules and regulations. But the rules and regulations are that there is such a thing as safe harbor. There is, in fact, on KPFK, our LA station, a program at this very moment. Just starting, I think, because... No, they're 4 hours behind. Starts in about 45 minutes, I believe. Called Safe Harbor. And boy, does it make use of safe harbor. In England, by the way, they call the same thing watershed. There is a time of broadcasting when one can be adult in imagery and language. So, but nevertheless, the understanding of safe harbor is you don't just do it in conversation. And I just didn't have the time to go. I cut out about 5 or 6 instances, and it was too much. So I'm going to be listening instead, and we'll just have to hit the button at the appropriate moments. However, just in case, let me say that there is a vague possibility that this program will contain frank language. And if you are offended by frank language, please tune out and rejoin us, during Lister, and maybe, let's say, 5 a.m. I think we get an all-clear signal on naughtiness starting at 5 o'clock in the morning. So, who is David Gerald, you ask? Well, maybe... Okay, now if I remove this now, am I going to remove David Gerald's talk? I'm talking to myself about the technical things again. Let's see. Nope. It's there. Good. Okay. It's a long story. I carry a flash drive. I usually keep the flash drive on my keys. You know how many times I've gone home only to discover that I left my keys in the computer at we were in Harlem for a couple of years, and I would get home to the southern end of Brooklyn only to discover that I had to go back in the middle of the night to Harlem just to get my keys. Not fun! So now I put a thumb drive on a long keychain. You can't hear it, but... there it is. And I plug that in. But the interview, I left it in stereo because we were sitting apart from each other. And so there's actually audio separation between the two. David Gerald. Yeah. Oh, yeah. What was I going to talk about before I started the thing with David Gerald? Not a lot. I don't have a lot of time left, but suffice it to say the Hugo Award nominations were revealed on April 4th, and they are, I would say, less controversial than the last 2 years, and somewhat predictable, some of those predictions being really, really good. Now, my partner, she was nominated for a Nebula for Best Short Story, but unfortunately not for a Hugo, but I'm not surprised. But the Nebula is the peer award. It's the award given out by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, which is a misnomer because it's not just America, it's all English-speaking countries. But it's a peer award. Other writers have said, we like you. Whereas the Hugo Award is you pay your money and you can vote. And there are people of certain political persuasions who've been trying for a couple of years now to sway the Hugos in a religious right direction. And so the Hugos have become highly politicized. And even if when they weren't, they were still, I don't want to say a People's Choice Award, but they were a fan award. Well, a fan award is a good thing. It tells you what people are reading. But the Nebulas tell you what other writers think of your work. And then there's the World Fantasy Award, which is a totally different thing because, among other things, it's just fantasy. It doesn't include science fiction. And the World Fantasy Award is juried. It's judged by a very small number of people. So those are the three different ways of doing it. But most of the Hugo nominees are worthy, well worthy of nomination. I'm still annoyed that they have something that they call Best Fan Cast. Well, that doesn't include this radio program because, by definitions, it's not a fan cast. It's pro. I work for a magazine, Lightspeed Magazine. For 2 years running, usually running up against Clark's World. Hope if you're listening a couple of months ago, you heard Neil Clark of Clark's World on this program. Very often Neil would win, and then when Clark's World was no longer considered a, quote, semi-prozine, but rather a prozine, he was no longer eligible for the category. I work for Lightspeed Magazine on their audio end, and Lightspeed is now no longer a semi-prozine. We're professional. Nice. There's no award for it. There's no best prozine. So we can't even vie for an award. The Hugos is weird, people. Anyway, a person who has won Hugo Awards and Nebula Awards and writing awards of all kinds. Oh, let me just backtrack one more thing. The Samuel R. Delaney event that we held on his birthday last Saturday was freaking fabulous. We had such a crowd that they just about locked the door to prevent more people from coming in, or else the fire law people would have been very dismayed. But we had a fabulous turnout. And if you want to watch it, you still can. Go to either the New York Review of Science Fiction group, NYRSF Nyersif Reading, on Facebook, or you can go to live stream and just under searching, type in Delaney or Nyersif, and you will find it, and you can watch the whole thing for yourself. Uncut, uncensored. Okay, back to what we're doing. David Gerald. Four words, and then you'll know who David Gerald is. The Trouble with Tribbles. I don't think there's too many people out there who don't know what that is. It's arguably either A, the best, or B, the most popular, C, possibly both, episode ever of Star Trek in any incarnation. David Gerald is the author of over 50 books, hundreds of articles and columns, and a dozen television episodes. He's a classic SF writer that will go down in history as having created, as opposed to who will go down in history, I think both will work, as having created some of the most popular and redefining scripts, books, and short stories in the genre. I'm reading this, by the way, from his website. His TV credits include episodes from Star Trek, The Trouble with Tribbles and the Cloud Minders, Star Trek Animated, More Tribbles, More Troubles, and BEM, B-E-M, Babylon 5, Believers, Twilight Zone, A Day in Beaumont, and A Saucer of Loneliness, based on one of my favorite Theodore Sturgeon short stories. Land of the Lost, remember that? He wrote Shaka and the Sleestak God, Hurricane, Possession, and Circle, Tales from the Dark Side, where he wrote Levitation and If the Shoes Fit, the series Logan's Run, Man Out of Time, and others. His novels include When Harley Was One, The Man Who Folded Himself, The War Against the... Cthor, C-H-T-O-R-R, Septology, the Starwolf Trilogy, the Dingiliad Young Adult Trilogy, the Trackers Duology, and many more sci-fi classics. Additionally, the autobiographical tale of his son's adoption, The Martian Child, won the Hugo and Nebula Awards for Best Novelette of the Year and was the basis for the 2007 movie, Martian Child, starring John Cusack, Amanda Peet, and Joan Cusack. Unfortunately, not a great film. This was Heliosphere is a new science fiction in science fiction convention in New York, and it was a lot of fun, if a bit underattended, but it was its first year. And David Gerald was the first guest of honor, and I had the honor doing the guest of honor interview. I will, by the way, be doing the same at Lunacon this coming weekend. For more information, go to lunacon.org. The guest of honor there is Ben Bova, and I will be interviewing him. I am also running the Reader's Track, 3 days of science fiction writers reading their work. We have approximately 40 different writers, and I'm very pleased with the way the program came out. Also, on Friday evening, I will be teaching a workshop on reading your own work aloud, how to do it, things to avoid, not to avoid,
how to use a microphone,
things like that. So, go to lunacon.org. And in the meantime, I have overstayed my welcome. So please now set your Wayback Machine for about a month ago, March 11th, to be precise, in the year 17, and join us as we listen to an interview with the amazing writer, David Gerald. We are recording, but before we begin, I will explain that this is not just the, obviously, GOH speech, but this is also a radio show. I do a radio show called Hour of the Wolf. I have flyers here. I even have, believe it or not, I do have to show this off. David has his books, and you can get an autographed copy of The Man Who Folded Himself. I'm sorry, I've been calling that since it came out, because what scene prompted that. Mm-hmm. That scene in the book. And I have an audiobook set of about 18 of my interviews I've done through the years, volume 2, this might be in it. So this will be end up being on my, hey Charlie, my radio, and Lorraine, this will be on my radio show called Hour of the Wolf. But that does mean, now it's exactly noon, that I will slate, but what's today's date?
I think it's the 11th. Is today the 11th?
March 11th, 2017 at high noon. And we are sitting in the back row. We are at Heliosphere, the inaugural Heliosphere in Tarrytown, New York, right near Sleepy Hollow. And I have interviewed a lot of people since I started in, God help me, 1967 as an intern at WBAI.
Wow. Yeah. Gosh, you're old.
And May 1st will be my 50th anniversary.
Congratulations.
Of working in radio. And wow. I have still not yet earned $100. my program, Hour of the Wolf, which was started by Margot Adler, is now on the air for...
I met Margot. I think I was on Hour of the Wolf back in the late 60s, early 70s.
We began in 72. I don't think I was the engineer.
73. I was on the show in 73.
I don't remember that.
Neither do I.
Yeah. That's when the show was still 5 days a week.
Yeah. Now, it was. I was in town for a Star Trek convention. It was either 73 or 74.
Oh, you know. So, I wasn't there because I would have
There was some late night TV show, cable, community cable thing that Dorothy Kilgallen's son, Kerry, was hosting, and people would call in and be rude to the guest. And my mistake was not getting up and leaving. So, because I was still thought I had to be polite in those days.
Ren.
So, today I no longer feel I have to be polite. I'm older. I don't have to. I'm going to die soon. I can say whatever I feel. So this is going to be a fun interview, right?
So, yeah, yes.
They're all going, oh boy, fashion systems.
So this is actually your second time on the show.
Yeah? Is that a record?
No.
Okay.
No, it isn't. But it's weird because I used to engineer almost all of Margot's shows, probably because there was a week of a Star Trek convention, and I was on the con committee.
Uh-huh.
So that's probably why I didn't make it to that particular show.
Yeah, that would have been one, yeah.
And I would have been very disappointed not to have met you, but I'm so thrilled to finally meet you. Uh-huh. You know, we've been on the air now for 5 minutes. I haven't said who you are.
If they haven't figured it out by now.
So everybody,
they're not real fans.
So this is a person who probably wrote the best Star Trek episode ever, Harlan, David Gerrold.
You realize both Harlan and I are fatal diseases to people who say things like that.
Yeah, I'm well, Harlan has been on the show
I know.
A few dozen times.
Yeah, Harlan's great.
And speaking...
Harlan's my big brother.
Harlan caused me to almost end up in the Supreme Court. That's true. We, after the Carlin decision, which was our radio station, we tested what could be broadcast in the middle of the night. And at that time, my show began at 5 a.m. So I broadcast him reading the story Shatterday.
Yes.
The day after he wrote it. And he read it at School for Visual Arts for Leo and Diane Dillon. And so I timed it. It's a 45-minute read.
Yeah.
And there are no curse words in the last 15 minutes. So I started it at 5:30 a.m. with all the curse words in it, everything. And I started with the usual frank language disclaimer and all that. And at 6 o'clock sharp, there were no more curse words. I backtimed it exactly. So that's what established now that between 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., you can broadcast Safe Harbor, which in the city where you live, there's a radio show by that name.
I don't know who listens to radio anymore.
Well, thank you.
well, we used to have Hour
25. We podcast as well.
We used to have Hour 25 hosted by the great Mike Odell. When he died, the show was taken over by Harlan, and Harlan passed it to Joe Straczynski just as well. I wanted it, but he passed it to Joe.
And Joe hardly ever did the show because
yeah.
I was supplying them with tapes.
Yeah, yeah.
When Joe, three out of four
and
shows.
Then, and KPFK finally had lost interest in the show. Joe passed it to Warren, Warren James.
Right.
Who you know, a NASA-bred scientist, brilliant man. But didn't have the sparkle that Harlan would bring to it.
Or Mike.
Yeah.
Mike was wonderful.
Oh, Mike was the best. Mike was so sharp, you could never get a leg over him. He always had the comeback. I only got him once in my entire career with Mike. I only got stopped him once. Is that the Sony Walkman had just come out, something like that. And everybody who had one was, you can't believe the sound, you know, and people would pass the earphones over. And Michael said, let me. And he put it on, he said, wait a minute. Can you get AIDS from this? And I said, of course you can. Haven't you ever heard of hearing aids?
But
that stopped him. That stopped him cold.
We'll
that
be
was
here
the
all
only
weekend.
Time, that was the only, every other time, if I would try to, you know, top him, he would have a comeback so fast.
Where's Ren? This is good. Sorry.
So, anyway.
Mike started in radio at WBAI.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was our news director.
Yeah.
And he worked with Margot Adler.
Mm-hmm.
So when Margot Adler did Hour of the Wolf Monday through Friday, Mike was her semi-co-host on Mondays, and I was her official co-host.
Mike had the best radio voice.
He's wonderful.
Ever. He had this deep voice.
At the Pacifica Archives, you can find him reading a couple of Tom Dish stories.
Yes.
And the Roaches,
yeah,
and some Kafka. He was wonderful. He was absolutely wonderful.
He was probably the best radio host I've ever known. So,
Thank you. Margot was my role model in many ways. And, well, the two of them were of a kind.
Yeah.
They really were. Mike died way too young. He was,
oh, absolutely.
What, 49?
Yeah, I was in Europe, and I knew he was sick, and my friends picked me up at the airport when I came back. We're driving back on the 405, and they told me Mike passed away while I was away. And I cried the length of the 405. And if you've ever been on the 405, you know, it's not your friend. It's all traffic. So it was a long cry. So I was like, this is not a 5 minute.
For a week, I was still on Monday through Friday then. For a week, I did nothing but play his shows.
Yeah.
And I still do occasionally. It's worth it. However, there's a mistaken entry in Wikipedia that says that Mike Hodel was the first person to play Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the original radio show, 4 years before the books, on Hour 25, and that's incorrect. I played them 2 days earlier.
Oh, okay.
And Mike serialized them, one per episode, and I did them all in 2 days. And the way this happened, quick story, Douglas Adams was touring the U.S., talking largely about the TV show he worked on called Doctor Who or something like that. And he was what today we would call a showrunner, but his title was script editor. And he had finished Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and the BBC at that point was no longer providing us at Pacifica Radio with stuff for free. They were charging outrageous amounts, which they still do. So, and you had to have, to play them, they were on these large transcription discs, like a record, but 14 inches big. We and KPFK and all the Pacifica stations had BBC transcription players.
Oh, good.
Douglas came to do an interview. I interviewed him. And really just knowing that he was like author of, what was it, the Pirates of whatever on Doctor Who, and was just being introduced to Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yeah.
And he somehow accidentally left 6 transcription discs with me.
How cool.
He then went to L.A., where he did the same thing with Mike Hodel. So Wikipedia's wrong. I got him first.
Okay.
And it can now be told that they were pirated illegally, and if the BBC wants to go after Douglas Adams, they know where to find him.
Yeah. He at least was not buried in a parking lot. The Brits are now putting signs in the parking lots that say, parking 2 hours, please do not bury any dead monarchs here. So.
And every hump day, anyway.
Anyway, so.
So, but I don't have the heart to go into Wikipedia and say, no, that's not true, because Mike Hodel is such an honored, great person that but at cons, I tell that story.
Yeah.
Okay, so you got interested, let's talk a little bit about writing. You started.
By the way, for those of you just tuning in, my name is David Gerald, and I wrote for Star Trek and Land of Lost and some other shows. Those of you who are wondering, because our host here has still not introduced
me. No, I did.
Yeah, but anyway.
I did, actually.
Very sloppily. Anyway.
Also, there will be an intro.
Yeah.
Now, I do have to pause. I hope anybody listening to this broadcast is well aware of the fact that I not only spent a lot of time introducing David, I read everything from his own website. So I didn't appreciate that, David.
Okay.
There will be a studio-provided intro.
All right.
And we're going to have a whole nice, proper introduction.
Oh, all right, good. Okay, so we're going to talk about writing now, right?
Well, that's how you started. How did you start?
I had a typewriter and I started typing.
There you go. You started with scripts?
I started with scripts. Somewhere I realized I have this kind of mental breaking down problems into separate pieces to solve them one piece at a time. And some people get overwhelmed. They only see the whole problem. I see, okay, we have to solve this and then this and then this. So I realized that you can't make a movie until you have a script. And so I was at USC Film School and took the screenwriting course from Erwin R. Blacker, where he taught structure. And it was the perfect class for me because he broke down script into the separate parts of the problem you have to solve to do a script. So I understood story structure and script format from Erwin R. Blacker, who was just probably, I mean, he there was no, oh, you got to have your passion and your story and your, you know, there's no artsy fartsy. It's you got to learn your craftsy before you learn your artsy, right? He was very down to earth. He was a no bullshit kind of guy. So, and he was very unpopular among the other students because he was just, he didn't have to like you. He had to teach you. So he was this gruff guy. And I loved him for it. I said, oh, great. This guy is not going to waste my time. He's going to go right down to business. It's like kind of like what's his name in Full Metal Jacket, you know, the DI.
Oh God.
So anyway, a couple years later, I'm out at CSUN studying theater arts because you once you can write a script, are the words speakable? Can you actually speak? Can an actor say these words? And so there's a connection.
Trippingly on the tongue.
There is a connection between the words on the page and the actor who has to say them. And I've seen scripts that have been written by writers who have absolutely no idea how a sentence has to be spoken. There's the English language has a specific rhythm. It's an iambic, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. It's like the heartbeat. Whereas French has a different rhythm, Spanish has a different rhythm, Bulgarian has a different rhythm. And even if you do not speak those languages, you can recognize the rhythms. And in fact, I noticed the first time I was in Paris after a couple of days, my brain wanted to speak in the French rhythm, even though my words were English. And when I lived in Dublin for a while, the Irish have such a lovely lilt to the language. It could still be English, but you know, there's a rhythm to the Irish. And so, but as an actor, when you pick up a script, you don't want to, you know, six paragraphs of double talk. You want to be able to find the emotion in the line. So the thing that you as a writer, or I as a writer, would have to master, and that's where the acting classes came in very handy, is when you're standing there with a script in your hand and you have a line of dialogue, can you say that line of dialogue as if that's who you really are? Or can you be the character that line suggests? So if the character is Irish, can you speak it like an Irishman? Or Scots, which I've been ordered by several Scots people not to attempt the Scots dialect, even though I studied it for 6 months trying to get a specific part. But that's it, is that the relationship between the word on the page and when it's spoken. If the writer doesn't understand that these have to be spoken aloud, and not just spoken aloud, but convincingly as a real character, as a real person, then he's cheating. He's cheating not only himself, but the actor and the director and the audience, who has to try and believe in this character, despite the fact that there's dialogue coming out of this character's mouth that is simply abominable. And a lot of second-rate and lazy and just plain lousy writers put stuff down on the page without stopping to think, is this believable? Is, you know, or someone has to say this? Would it work? And you can find a lot of these amateur films online these days.
Or you can watch Star Wars.
No.
Well, you know that classic story.
Yeah.
Where Harrison Ford stops somewhere during the movie and saying, George, you know nobody can say this stuff.
Actually, I have seen the first reel of Star Wars with the original dialogue, and it is pretty bad dialogue. The legend has it that Carrie Fisher and Harrison Ford and Mark Hamill tied up George Lucas to a chair and weren't going to let him out until they could rewrite the dialogue, fix the dialogue. And it's pretty clear to me that Carrie Fisher script doctored that first script, because there are still places where, Darth Vader, I thought I smelled your foul stench when I came aboard. That is from Lucas's script. But when you get this walking carpet out of my way, that is clearly Carrie Fisher. The real story of 2001 is that Gary Lockwood was getting angrier and angrier as they're shooting the middle section. And Kubrick said, "Gary, what's wrong?" And Gary told him, I heard this from Gary Lockwood. Gary told him, "There's too much talk and it's not believable." And Kubrick shut down production for 3 days while they trimmed a lot of the dialogue out. And Arthur C. Clarke, who had expected that his narration and a lot of other dialogue was going to be in the picture, was very disappointed that the picture was so minimalist. Well, but in retrospect, you look at the movie, it works better without a lot of talk. Because when you're in space, everybody's been trained to do their job. There's not a lot of talking you have to do except, you know, check, done. You know, like, so the what Kubrick captured was the loneliness of the long-distance space voyage. And all the dialogue would have taken away from it. I mean, come on, let's face it. If you're locked up in a tank with someone for however many months, after the first few weeks, you guys have said everything that you need to say, and you've told each other's joke, you know each other's life story. There's nothing left to say. You know, you want some coffee? Okay. That's about it. That's your conversation for the day. You know, this is why marriages hit that point 8 months in. You know, you've said everything there's... Oh, God. What are we going to talk about now?
So,
anyway.
So I distracted you, which is what I do. So going back to USC and making the dialogue speakable.
Well, actually, I learned more of that at CSUN, but at USC I learned about story structure. And then what happened is in my final year of college, there was this show on TV that was supposed to be science fiction. I thought, yeah, it'll be another Lost in Space. They'll crap it up. And I looked at the first episode, and I go, oh, yeah, a guy with no emotions, how that's not going to play. Boy, big deal, an alien with pointed ears. You know, it's like, monster of the week, all right. And then about midway through the first act, they beam down. Oh, great, transporter, give me a break. The physics on that are just, you know. And I'm just not... And that is the stupidest looking spaceship I've ever seen, right? And they're doing archaeology on an alien pyramid, and I look at the art direction, and the doorway to the pyramid is not human proportioned. And I go, ooh, they got one right. Okay, maybe there's hope for this show, right? I'm being real arrogant about that, right? And I thought, I don't want them to screw it up. I'm going to write them I know my script format, and I know science fiction. I've been reading science fiction since before I learned how to read. So I'll write them, and I wrote an outline and sent it in the following Monday.
Pretty huge outline.
Yeah, it was a two-parter, because I wanted to get it. And Gene Okun was so impressed that he called me in for a meeting and said, look, we're all bought up. But submit stuff for our second season if we're renewed. And I did the math that there's only 4,000 members in the Writers Guild at that time, and at least half of them were retired or not working in TV. Some were still working in radio. Others had not yet learned the hour-long format. And there were maybe only 100 who understood science fiction. So I figured I'm only competing with about 100 other writers. I only have to be better than, let's see, Harlan Ellison, Theodore Sturgeon, Jerome Bixby, Jerry Saul, Richard Matheson, Robert Bly. Okay, so now that I know the challenge, because if I'm only as good as those guys, they're not going to buy it. They're going to buy, you know, we don't know this guy, but we know these guys, and we know they can deliver. So I have to do something spectacular to get noticed. So I submitted a bunch of outlines, four of which were probably pretty dreadful. I do not remember them. And three which were dreadful. The one which I thought was had a lot of fun was called Bandy. It was about a little teddy bear creature. The idea that the real dangerous aliens will be the ones we don't recognize as dangerous because they're cute, which is where Tribbles came from. Dorothy Fontana read the outline and said, this has whimsy, let's give it to a real writer. And... No, come on, she didn't know me. And Gene Okun said, let's give the kid a chance and see what he can do. And they bought the story, we tweaked the outline a little bit, and I went home and wrote the first draft in 4 days.
How did you learn the characters?
That was the fun part. I asked if I could visit the soundstage, and because I had been trained, you do not interrupt production. You keep out of people's way. Otherwise, you're going to be escorted off the lot by these two big burly guards, right? So I asked permission. May I please visit the soundstage? Yeah, yeah, go out here, turn left. And it's stage 9 and 10. No problem. And things were a lot more relaxed in those days on the lots. And so you can just wander around the lot and walk into, you know, if I had been brave, I would have looked to see what they're doing in Mannix and Mission Possible. I wandered into the soundstage and walked the corridor of the Enterprise. It was very overwhelming to actually be aboard the Enterprise for the first time, right? And one by one, over the next few days, whenever I was on the lot, I'd visit the set. And one by one, I met the different actors. And I would listen to how they spoke. And I would sit in on dailies so I could see what they were shooting, so I could hear their speech patterns. Meanwhile, I was watching all the episodes that were being rerun. I was reading every script that I could get my hands on. So if somebody left a script on their chair, I read it. I read half the scripts of the new season before some had been filmed, some hadn't been filmed yet. So I was reading the scripts, watching the dailies, and watching them shoot, and listening to the actors, how they spoke, so that I could pick up the rhythms of how they spoke. So Jimmy Doohan has this particular, I cannot give you none my power. So once you listen for that. And Mr. Spock has this very deliberate, very deliberate, not pretentious, but very specific, precise way of speaking. So, you know, I wonder how long we've been here. 17 minutes and 33 seconds, Captain. You know, and so it's not robotic, but there is a mechanical precision to it. And Kirk is a particularly interesting rhythm to capture, because it is not as the comedians have. If we could just find our way to the last word of this sentence, which is what the comedians do. But that's not how Bill talks. That's how Bill is struggling to remember the line. He would. Bill Shatner is a workaholic. He has to be there at 6 o'clock in the morning for makeup, choose which hairpiece, whatever. I'm not making fun. I'm not making fun. This is serious business.
This is stuff that Shatner himself cops to. He really does.
He's there 5 days a week, and he's in almost every single scene in the entire. So he's there every single day from early in the morning to late in the evening until they wrap at 6. So he's got a 12-hour day, and he's got to memorize as much as 6 pages a day, whereas anybody else, and now Spock has to be there at the same time because the ears take an hour, and Spock is usually in most of the same scenes with Kirk, but not all of them. But the others, is the show's originally designed, their sidekicks or ensemble or background or scenery or Seven Dwarfs, whatever you want to call them, they're only there 1 or 2 days. They're only there for 1 or 2 days a week. They have their scenes, you know, they have the bridge scene, they have the this. In a bottle show, they might be there 3 days. But the only one who is working in every scene is Kirk. And so Shatner is got to learn 6 pages a day. And the Mark Daniels and Joe Pevney, two great directors. Mark Daniels did all the I Love Lucy's. So he certainly understood the timing, the precision. But there's a thing that some directors knew and some directors didn't, is you've got to do 3 or 4 or 5 takes with Bill Shatner until he gets tired of acting. And that's when you get your best performance out of him. Bill is Shakespearean trained, and he's always acting to the back row of the theater. So to get what you need on camera, you got to let him get comfortable with the lines and whatever. So they would do usually 3 or 4 takes of anything. And if there's camera moves or lighting or whatever, or anything complicated, it does take time. So a lot of what you're doing is sitting around and waiting. But see, you know, for all of the crap that gets thrown at Bill Shatner, the very first day they were shooting a scene from Doomsday Machine, and it is the scene where he's in the on the other starship, and he's in the backup bridge or whatever, and he sees Decker get killed. And Mark Daniels and Jerry Finnerman are setting up the shot, and Shatner says to him, "Look, when I hear the news that he's, when I see him get killed, I lower my head. Why don't you put a flag on the light so I lower my head into shadow, and that'll help sell it." And I was so impressed that Shatner was thinking about the shot, not his performance. You know, because people say, oh, Shatner was counting lines and he was feuding. No, Shatner was always thinking about how it was going to work for the audience. And I have admired him ever since then. And a few of my Facebook friends are very much aware that if somebody says something bad about Bill Shatner, not only do they get unfriended, sometimes they even get blocked. That you do not trash Bill Shatner or Harlan Ellison or anybody who is close to me on my Facebook wall and expect their death. You know, I'm not going to be a part of that conversation. I'm not going to have it on my wall. I'm not going to have my silence be interpreted as agreement. I'm going to say, no, you don't get to do that in my living room.
I have a line about Shatner when people badmouth him. I say, go home, watch Judgment at Nuremberg.
Yes, yes.
And watch Shatner act with Spencer Tracy.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not Kirk. He doesn't do that halting thing. He's with possibly one of the greatest actors of the 20th century. He holds his own.
Bill was the go-to guy. He'd never been in a series before, but when you needed a guy who had presence for, you know, there's the Thriller anthology series, there's the Alfred Hitchcock anthology series, there's a Western over here, whatever, Bill was the go-to guy. So when Jeffrey Hunter said, I don't want to come back to Star Trek, and he probably did us all a favor, it was his wife said, Jeffrey doesn't want to come back. Okay, fine. So they said, who are we going to... Well, there's this guy, Bill Shatner, that everybody likes. One of the other actors they were considering was James Coburn, who would have been a very interesting Captain Kirk, probably not as eager to get into fistfights, but the thing is that what we discovered working with Bill and Gene Okun is that Bill loved doing comedy, and the Trouble with Tribbles episode was that, oh wow, we get to be funny for a change. And there were those who said, well, Star Trek is not a comedy, but if you look at the fan reaction, the fans wanted a break. Do we have to save the galaxy every week? It's like, come on. Once in a while, we just have one of those little problems that creeps up on us because our attention is elsewhere. And that was the whole point, is that once in a while, we have a little story to contrast with the big stories. And part of this was a conversation we had after Dr. No and From Russia with Love came out, is why were these pictures so much fun? Is because they weren't all straight action. After every action bit, James Bond had something funny to say. Like, well, she's had her kicks, if you remember From Russia with Love. So,
let her sit here. She's just dead.
And, yeah. And so...
Thunderbolt.
Yeah. So, that came after Trek, though.
Yeah.
But anyway, we had conversations as writers that this was something that an adventure could have comedy in it. And once we as writers started realizing we could play the action, you know, because we know these action shows are fantasies anyway, well, let's have some fun in the fantasy. And of course, for me, the model has always been Burt Lancaster in The Crimson Pirate, which if you have not, just go hunt that one down. You will have a great time. It holds up. It's one of the greatest movies ever. He's working with his old trapeze partner. And the
very much in the Douglas Fairbanks.
We haven't seen anything like that since Douglas Fairbanks. So so I have only wonderful things to say about the entire cast, because one of the things that became very apparent in the script, I decided I want to see all these other characters. I want to see Uhura, and I want to see Chekhov, and I want to see Scotty. I want to see everybody else. Every character got their page. So instead of just, I can't give you now my power, it's Hi, Captain, thank you. Now I can go catch up on my technical journals. You know, who started the fight, Scotty, right? So every character got to do something different. And this was a specific choice. And because so many other writers had focused so much on Spock, I didn't use Spock as much. And I later apologized to Leonard, and he said, it's okay. Did you notice how well I follow Bill? And he said, Leonard had a great sense of humor. Leonard was, he was marvelous. Once you got past the fact that you're talking to Mr. Spock. So I specifically wrote something for every actor to have something fun to do. And I think that was one of the other reasons why the fans like the Tribble episode so much, is that we get to see the rest of the crew, the rest of our primary ensemble, doing something fun.
And you also introduced one of the great characters ever created for Star Trek.
Who?
The Harcourt.
Harcourt? No, I didn't introduce
no, you
Harcourt.
Didn't do,
no,
okay.
Stephen Kendall did Harcourt Fenton Munn.
Did he? Okay.
I did Cyrano Jones.
So,
My biggest mistake was I never described Cyrano Jones the way I should have, because I always imagined him as being played by Boris Karloff, and I expected, and if I had said in the script he's a Boris Karloff type, they would have picked up the phone and said, Boris, you want to be on Star Trek? And if Boris Karloff had played Cyrano Jones, I'm saying, can I interest you in a harmless little tribble? If Boris Karloff had played Cyrano Jones, the episode certainly would have won the Hugo over City on the Edge. Would have known. Wait a minute. Boris Karloff, don't trust him. From the beginning, you would have known tribbles are trouble. So that was my big mistake, and I will go to my grave regret, because I would have loved to have seen Boris.
I made the mistake because Harcourt, in a way, is another Cyrano.
Bob Justman wrote a memo saying, doesn't this character remind you of Harry Mudd? And so I think that put the image in their mind. But I talked to Joe D'Agostino, who did the casting. I saw him a few months ago. We did a panel. And I said, wouldn't it have been fun to get Boris Karloff? And he just started laughing and laughing and laughing. He said, oh, my God, David, that's wonderful. So...
So now you're making me think Peter Lorre would have been.
No. Although Peter and Boris and Vincent were all working for Roger Corman at the time. They were doing those wonderful things like Comedy of Terror. Comedy of Terrors, which was, they were having so much fun doing those Corman pictures.
I think The Raven was my favorite.
The Raven, yeah. It does that. Tell me, will I ever find my lost little? How the hell should I know I'm a bird? That I remember sitting in the audience and we howled. We knew in that moment that we were going to have a great time with that movie.
So why haven't you done more voice acting? You're so good.
I have.
There's
a fellow named William Winkler, who the Japanese owners of various anime films have had. They sent him something like 30 films, and I. He called me and said, he doesn't pay very much, but I went for the fun. And he started calling me the man with 1,000 voices, because we would, I'd get in the booth and he would say, David, I only need 2 lines here from the French chef. And I look and says, I'm trying to remember the line is, and I just shouted into the microphone, my kitchen is as clean as a weasel. And he says, okay, that's it. And I forget what the other line was.
I didn't know you did all that.
And then Kitaro's Graveyard Adventure, or Graveyard Gang, and he says, okay, so I need you to play the dad who has been, he's a zombie and all that's left is his eyeball. So I'm doing the zombie eyeball. And then he says, now, we also need you to do the ice giant. I am the ice giant. And then he has the zombie dad arguing with the ice giant. So I have not played the... I'm doing the voices better now, because after, you know, because when you're in the booth, it's like smaller than a TARDIS, right? And you're in the booth and you just do what, you know, you don't have time to go off and go invent something. You just do what you can at the moment. I did a lot of shrieking. I would end up at the end of the day hoarse for 3 days, because a lot of, you know, it's anime. So You can't depend on the animation to sell something with voice acting. You have to sell it with the voice. So I would love to do more, but I just haven't followed through with doing an audition tape.
You did Sitting on the Edge of Forever with Skyboat Media.
Yes, I did. I was not happy with I thought I could do better. But I did do their narration.
I worked for Skyboat Media.
Stephen Radecki did the audiobook of Harlan Ellison's script.
The original came out last.
Yeah, it is available, and they had a lot of good people.
I have 20 copies, and I forgot to bring.
I showed up at the recording, and here's this handsome black guy, and he smiles at me and waves at me. And David, and said, "Oh, LeVar, I didn't recognize you without the hand." So, yeah, I mean, LeVar has this most wonderful, expressive eyes. He's such a great actor. And so what do we do on Next Generation? Gave him this thing where he couldn't have his own crap. Anyway, but LeVar, to give LeVar credit, he did an extraordinary job producing the remake of Roots, which, if you have not seen it, hunt it down. I think it's on Amazon now, but... or you can download it from the Pirate Bay. And they were up for an Emmy for it. They got beat out by the O.J. Simpson miniseries. But if you have not seen Roots, either iteration, check out what LeVar did, because I was so proud of that job. He was just amazingly good producer.
Yeah. Why haven't you read more audiobooks?
I did do the audiobook of When Harley Was One.
Right.
I offered to do more, but they said, no, we're going to get some other people. So I will do more readings, but, the thing is that if you get the spontaneity, it plays. But if you when you're in the booth, somehow the spontaneity disappears because I got to get this right. So.
Yeah, talk to Stefan. He'll...
Yeah, Stefan and I, we do want to do something together. So yeah, probably...
Stefan Radecki runs Skyboat Media. He produces the Lightspeed magazine podcast, for which I'm the audio editor and host.
We had a lot of fun, and Stefan, or Stefan, however you want to pronounce it, he's a great guy. I cannot say enough nice things about the whole production team there and Stefan. So anyway.
I'm the New York.
All right, yeah. So you have another question?
Very junior.
I think we have 5 minutes left. You have another question?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
There was one interview I did once.
We actually have an hour left, but...
Yeah, there was one interview I did once where they said, we have a list of questions, said, just ask the first one and shut up.
it pretty much goes. Okay, so that was how you started with the writing, but that was scripts. How did you turn to prose?
The hard way. You sit and you type. The nice thing about a script is that you master dialogue very, very quickly. Or you don't. But the essence of storytelling is in the space that happens between two characters. And script writing is a really fast way to focus on the relationships and the motivations and the emotional movement of the story. See, every scene, you don't want to go longer than 2.5 pages, unless it's very, very important. And every scene, so you have to set up this little conflict, this tension, this disagreement, this whatever is happening, and whatever the emotional state of these two characters are, at the beginning of the scene, at the end of the scene, one or the other must have shifted to a different emotional state, or both. And because if nothing happens, if there's no emotional shift, there's no motion. And so once you get that about a scene, then you have mastered the important part of the drama. Now, turning it into prose is, how do you write a sentence that a reader can read and not go, oh, fuck, this guy doesn't know what he's doing. And I'm not going to identify the author, because I admired and loved him very much, and he's no longer with us. But I picked up one of his later books, which, with a great deal of eagerness, and 4 pages in, I put it down. I could not read it, because his sentences were so clunky that they were hard to decode. And I realized what had happened. Theodore Sturgeon had taught me a lesson about, and again, the English language has its rhythm. And if you write to a specific poetic rhythm, you will create a specific mood in that paragraph. And don't go too long with that rhythm, but and if you shift rhythms, you shift the emotional tenor of that paragraph. So, you know, it's for instance, the boy stood on the burning deck, his feet were full of blisters, he tore his pants upon a nail, and now he wears his sister's, is a specific rhythm. And if you take out the rhyme, you still have the rhythm, you see. And the reader will be carried along by that rhythm. And there's lots of different rhythms. I am not a poet. I have 30 poems to prove it. Learning how to write to a specific rhythm, it forces you to find specific ways of saying things. You have to find other word choices to keep the rhythm going. Now, if you do not have any understanding of that rhythm, if you're just typing the words that you think are the most precise, you end up with these very clunky sentences that if it doesn't sound good when you speak it aloud, it's not going to sound good in the reader's head. So the trick that I used is I would speak things aloud. I would speak a sentence aloud and listen to what it sounded like, and then I'd type it, and I no longer have to do that, although there are times when I will still do it to hear how it sounds, to hear if, but generally you want the prose to flow. So I was always worried about style, and there's no such thing as style. There's voice. When you find the voice and the rhythm, then you get this prose that not only flows when you read it aloud, but it flows inside the reader's head when he just reads the story and gets caught up in the mood. And there are people who do that. There's a guy named Bernard Wolfe did a book called Limbo, which is hard to find, obscure, but he has paragraphs in it, places in it, where what he does with language is so astonishing. There's another book called Middlesex by Jeffrey Eugenides, where in the middle of the book he tells you what it's like to work on the assembly line in Detroit. And it is one of the most brilliant fucking pieces of writing I have ever read anywhere, because he's giving you the rhythm of the machine as it's pounding. And he traces the entire process from the water that's flowing down the river and turning the wheel to generate the electricity to run the belt that turns the machine that pounds, and then stamps the frame. And by the time you are through with this chapter, you feel like you've been working 8 hours in an automobile factory, and that you're walking away and your head is still ringing. And it is a demonstration of what real writing is, that marriage of poetry and prose. And I'm so jealous because I can't do it. I can only appreciate it and occasionally aspire to it. Another voice is Michael Chabon in the Yiddish Policemen's Union. He captures that Jewish voice. He overdid it. He's like halfway through it and say, "Oh my God, this is like Passover with my family. I can't do it anymore. Oh God, let me out of the room." I mean, but it was brilliantly done. and he's a Pulitzer Prize winner. And what's funny is I met him a few years ago, and we were ooh and aahing. I said, "My God, man, you did this wonderful." And he's going, "Oh, you wrote for Star Trek. Oh, my God." So when you have a Pulitzer Prize winner ooing and aahing over you, it's...
He wrote John Carter.
Yeah. And, hell, I have a tribble that spent 6 months on the space station. The astronaut who took it there is ooing and aahing. I get to sit with a science fiction writer. it's a strange world. Anyway,
thank God for that.
So, there's this to get from script to prose is you in a screenplay, you want to write the single most precise sentence you can for the people who have to build the props and the costume, the sets and the lighting. So you don't have to describe every little frill on the costume or it's like, as they approach the haunted house, you don't even have to say haunted house. As they approach the house, they look up and see something that would trouble the nightmares of Dracula. And then the art director knows what to do, right? What you do is you write to create, to give the production crew instructions on the mood that they are supposed to set. So you don't say, he's wearing a blue coat with a red tie. No, unless, you know, the uniform of the British soldier of 1898 is this. Please get this right. You would do that if you were doing a period piece or something like that. But your job as a script writer is to give a precise sentence. And Dorothy Fontana taught me a great lesson. She says, Kirk doesn't just react. He reacts a specific way. You can't say Kirk reacts. You have to say Kirk reacts sharply or reacts in horror or reacts amused. Tell Bill how Kirk reacts. And so I'm pretty sure Bill will figure it out. But she meant that in general, you always say, you always give the adverb how that character is reacting. So the actor will know what they're doing. Not every actor is as nuanced or as intelligent as Bill or Leonard. So, and boy, they could find things. You could write a really stupid line of dialogue and they could make it work. Spock's brain is evidence of that. So, which I always thought Spock's brain, that was written by Gene L. Kuhn under a pen name. I always thought that was his revenge for getting fired. But it turns out that they set out to do, and they had just heard about the first heart transplant, and they thought, what else can you transplant? And they said, well, let's see if what we can do with a brain transplant. And I think, while I admire the ambition, I think the thing got out of control. It was not a strong episode. So,
but in Hollywood, the idea of a brain transplant is really...
It's old. It's like I'm going to take your brain and put it in the body of the gorilla. It goes back to the 30s. You know, it's the Three Stooges episode. So, anyway, I'm not sure I want a gorilla with a bonk. So, anyway, but to get from the script to prose, once you have mastered the, or even gotten a sense of how of your job is to be precise and evoke the mood. Or portray the mood for the people who are building the props and costumes, then you realize your job as the storyteller is to evoke the experience, to evoke the mood, to evoke the emotion. Now, Ted Sturgeon would say, you need to know what's in every nook and cranny. You don't have to write it, but you need to know that it's there because that will show up in the way you tell the story. So, and I did a sequel to Mr. Costello Hero, which is, it's a very small story by Ted, but it's a brilliant little piece because he does the voice, does it in the voice of a guy who's not all really smart.
Who's also done an X-1.
Yeah. And so I did a sequel called The Further Adventures of Mr. Costello. I did not use the same character, the same voice, but when I went through the story, I know what's in every nook and cranny. And if I reread the story, I can feel the world. I don't know what the reader is getting, but I know that I got Ted right in that one because it's a David Gerrold story with a Ted Sturgeon character, but it definitely needed to be told the way it is. So, and again, there's a voice. It's a very rural Western voice that fades away as you find out who the character really is. So, and a couple people complained, we never find out the character's name. I said, yeah, and I never told you if the character's male or female either. because it can be read either way. Which makes for, if you know that, then some of the conversations between, some of the romantic conversations are, wait a minute, is this two men, or a man and a woman, or a man and someone who used to be a woman but who's a man now, or whatever. So, which I did that deliberately because there are people who are saying science fiction should only be straight white men having adventures and no messages and themes. And it's bullshit. It's all messages and themes.
Always was.
Yeah. So, thank you. Anyway, but mastering prose is a challenge, and it is one that I, as a storyteller, as a writer, have spent at least a half century working on, and if I had another half century, I might actually start getting good at it. It is that difficult a challenge to how do you master the paragraph? The blank page is the enemy, but I figure if I can read a paragraph I've written and not flinch, I'm okay. I'm a really tough critic. And I think I had this conversation yesterday. I'll repeat it. It says, somebody was asking me about writing, and I said, well, it's like masturbation. You're performing for an audience of one, and you will know if you got the job done. You will know if you satisfied that particular audience. And if you haven't satisfied that particular audience, it didn't work. But, you know, if you write for that audience of one, you know one person had a good time. And you go and you wash your hands afterwards. But if one person had a good time, if the writer had a good time, then you know one person on the planet enjoyed it. And it's likely that other people will have a good time with the story. But if you didn't enjoy writing it, there's no evidence that anyone will enjoy reading it. So that's my attitude about writing, is I have to enjoy the story on some level, whether it's scary or funny or an adventure or whatever. The Martian Child is a good example. How many people in here have kids? So, all right, so you know the experience. Most of the time, they're a blur. It's late at night, you've tucked them into bed, you wait a little bit, they're sound asleep, and you go in and you look at them, and you finally get to see what they look like. They're peaceful, they're asleep, they're cherubic, they're just beautiful little creatures. And you're standing there with the pillow in both hands, and you say, one more night, okay, I'll wait. So the first 6 weeks of parenting, whether you get a baby or you adopt a kid, the first 8 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, 2 months, you're going through this, who let this loathsome reptilian thing into my life? How did this happen? You know, whose good idea was this? And finally, you know, you reach this point, well, it may be a Martian, but it's my Martian. And so that's the story, is about the process of falling in love with your own kid. That's all it was about. And one night, after tucking Sean into bed and seeing that, you know, this little owl-eyed urchin was, I actually liked having him in my life, I went and wrote this story about how much I love my little boy. And the first, I don't know, dozen editors rejected it. They knew me too well, or it's embarrassingly earnest, or I don't know what the story is here. Kristen Catherine Rush, I didn't know her very well, and she didn't know me very well, but she published a story in FNSF, and I figured, well, it's either the biggest embarrassment of my career or brilliant. I can't tell. And then we started getting fan mail on the story, and that people said it. One guy said, I've been reading this magazine since issue number one. This is the best story you've ever published. By everything this guy writes, I love this letter. Then of course the story ended up taking home a Hugo and a Locus and a Nebula and missed the Sturgeon Award, though, which it was the most Sturgeon-esque of all the stories nominated. So, and I've been nominated for the Sturgeon Award, I think, two or three times. Okay, I'm the only one on the ballot who ever got trained by Sturgeon in metric prose. Well, all right. Anyway, coming back to the story, it was about evoking the emotion of parenthood. It was not about, I'm going to tell you a story about my kid. It's, I'm going to evoke this set of emotions. Which you start out with the panic and nervous and uncertainty about being a parent, all the way to the acceptance of, I'm stuck. So anyway, yeah. But that should answer the question about getting to the prose form somehow.
Yeah, we got there eventually in great, wonderful detail. To go along with that, you've written in so many different forms, from the script to short stories to novellas,
and
novels,
a play.
Pardon me. What is your favorite preferred form?
You know, it's kind of like I have these two little dogs, and whichever one is sitting on my lap, I'm saying, "You're my favorite dog in the whole world." And it's that, yeah, they don't care. What's your favorite story? The one in front of me while I'm typing.
Yeah, but my question is actually a more pragmatic one, because it can take...
Yes, but what my... Well, in terms of pay, a television episode is the best, because it's at most a month or 6 weeks' worth of work, and it's $30,000, $35,000, $40,000, plus residuals in perpetuity, which is why they're so hard to get. Why? Because the show is now staff-written, and they want to hang on to the residuals. They're not doing it just for the, you know, there's five of us, we're splitting $40,000. They're not doing it. They're doing it because they're taking home $20,000 a week, but the residuals that they will get from that one episode will go on forever. And if it's a hit series like Star Trek Next Generation that is going to go on for 100 years, those residuals will just keep coming in. There's no residuals from The Trouble with Tribbles because that contract didn't require residuals in perpetuity. So the guys who did the Tribbles crossover, they're getting residuals on Tribbles. I'm not.
Right.
But in terms of big paychecks, a screenplay is supposed to be worth, you know, anywhere from $250,000 to up, depending on the size of the budget. But my preferred format would be a play. I have always thought that real drama is what happens in space between two characters. And I wanted to write a play that was just two characters on a bare stage. It was like, there's these great plays like Death Trap and Sleuth with just two character plays, but those are murder mysteries. I don't even want a murder in this one. I just want two characters, what's happening between them.
Of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead.
Yeah.
Are just two people on a stage.
Yeah.
And of course,
not the
Gatto.
Movie version. Yeah. And Waiting for Godot, yeah.
Gatto.
Is it Gatto?
It is Gatto.
Well,
in my Samuel Beckett.
Well, what does Beckett know?
Nah.
He called. He'll be late. You didn't get the message. So anyway...
what was the line? Somebody said, that production was so bad that Gatto actually showed up.
I wish I could... anyway. So I did... I finally found a thing that sparked a whole idea. And I wrote a play called Uncle Daddy Will Not Be Invited. And... it's on my Megapack, the flash drive that we sell, the video of it too. We did it at CSUN, the incredibly, two very talented actors. I lucked out with the actors, and in 2.5 weeks they were off book, and we did several performances and got standing ovations every single night. And I look back at that script and think, this is very intense. This is what drama should do. It's kind of like Tennessee Williams updated with a happy ending. And because Tennessee Williams, you know, you'd sit through a Tennessee Williams play and then go out and, do I want to shoot myself or take cyanide? And sometimes even before the play is over. So anyway, I thought, why did anybody want to see a Tennessee Williams play? Anyway. So... it was only 65 minutes long.
Because they wanted to cheer up after an O'Neill play.
Yeah, right. Very good. Yeah, I have. Stay away from anything that says Long Day's Journey into Night, you know.
Like, and that Bergman Film Festival.
Yeah, right. So the play got such a great reaction that there were people saying, let's turn it into a movie. So I had to expand it. I had a third character. So now we have enough for a movie. And I showed it to one, and the producers are ready to go, and they're talking, well, we can fund this, we can do that. And one of the producers says, wait, let's take this to Broadway first. This will play. And so I'm waiting to, he sent it out to his Broadway people to see what their reaction is. And so when I get back to L.A., I'll find out.
Oh, cool.
So there'll either be a movie or a play or whatever. Thank you. But the thing is everybody who's read the script, they come away, this is so intense. And in fact, when we did it at CSUN, the entire theater arts department showed up to see it. And all the students afterwards were saying they were lined up to buy tickets for the second performance. Because they've been getting these nice safe shows like Cabaret or, you know, or West Side Story, you know. And they did not realize that what you could do on a stage, you could go this place on a stage. And there's a revenge in there. And so when I was a student at CSUN, they wouldn't let me do a directing project. So I finally got to come in and I did a directing project that blistered the paint on the walls. So prove I knew what I was doing. So anyway.
Have you ever thought of radio drama?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, see, I tend to think...
Radio drama is one of my favorite forms.
I've actually acted in radio drama.
I know you've acted.
But no, there was a group doing radio dramas for KPFK, and I was in three or four of them.
Yeah.
And that was okay.
Didn't Rene Aubergenois work with some of those people?
He did
at WBAI.
I don't know if he was doing that in L.A.
I worked with him there. So. And Lithgow, John Lithgow, was doing stuff at KPFK.
Are they doing anything recent?
I don't know about K and WBAI, our New York studio. Our current studios are so bad, we're not capable of radio drama right now, although we now have a performance space again, and I'm going to...
Finding a good... There's lots of great studios in L.A., but they all charge an arm and a leg, so, even though they're empty half the time, you know, but they can't lower their rates, so then everybody will want the lower rates. So.
Well, you know people.
Yeah,
I mentioned them earlier.
Okay, yes, I
and
do
they
know
do,
people.
They do full cast radio.
Yes, I do have to talk to Stefan about that.
Yeah.
So, you have another question, or are we done yet?
No, I think there's nothing more to talk to you about. Let's see. Do you want to continue talking about writing? You want to turn to real world?
Don't only ask me about stuff I know stuff about. If you ask me where I don't know, I'll say, I don't know. You ask about my pay grade.
Well, before we started recording, we were chatting a bit about the difficulty of finding solace in today's world. And one of the few things I can find solace in are you on Facebook, you and Julius Lester, who's a former BAI guy.
And don't forget Jim Wright. Adam Troy Castro, Adam Troy Castro is one of the most brilliant writers I know.
He really is.
He's one of the most insightful human beings I know.
Sweet guy.
Yeah, a wonderful guy. I read everything he does when I can get, especially on Facebook, just because I know I am going to learn something. And when as a storyteller, he's invented himself as his own genre, which is very hard to do. You know, because everybody's always working in nice, safe places. But Adam is just an amazing storyteller. I cannot say enough good things about him.
And his stuff, by the way, speaking of audio, all of his stuff sounds brilliant.
The reason I know how good he is he's shown me some stories that no editor wanted to touch. And I said, I wish I was editing a Dangerous Visions because I'd buy this one. He did one called Big Stoop and the... I don't remember the rest of the title, but it's a what if Superman, what if Kal-El had been raised by the family from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And as funny as that is, once you get the concept, when you read the story, it is both horrific and brilliant. And I just read it. I said, I want to do a Dangerous Visions anthology just so I can publish this story.
Here's a three-word question. Why don't you?
I have had a conversation with Eric Flint about that kind of a book. Part of the problem is funding it, and part of the problem is bringing in another editor. We talked to a couple other people, said, I don't want to go near that. Harlan said we could use a title Beyond Dangerous Visions, and then he called me a couple days and said, it turns out Dangerous Visions is copyright. I can't let you do that. So I thought, well, maybe we'll just do Beyond Danger or something like that, or Dangerous Beyond, or, you know, whatever. So, I mean, it's something I'd love to do. There's also, I'd love to do a book called The Joy of Science Fiction, which is, and I showed that list to David Hartwell a couple weeks before he died, the bastard. I miss that man so much.
I'm not forgiving him.
No, I'm not going to forgive him for dying either. It's just wrong. We needed at least another 50 years of David Hartwell. But he looked at the list and he said, boy, what a mess. And he says, there's some good. There's a nugget of something in here. And you know, we never had a chance to sit down and pursue it. Mm. But, I mean, the joy of science fiction is you would go to all of the best writers in the field. And like with Heinlein, you would take All You Zombies and The Man Who Traveled in Elephants. With Silverberg, you would take Passengers and maybe Night Wings. With Daniel Keyes, you would take flowers for Algernon with. So you would find that story that so represents the very best, the essence of that writer. And so that you would, in one anthology, you would have these all these classic stories, and then try and get, you know, classic artwork by M. Schwiller and and Bonestell and Frias and Gahn and Finlay and so on, to represent the golden age, so that younger readers would understand what their parents and grandparents found.
That would
be fiction.
I would envision that as a coffee table book.
Oh yeah, a big coffee table book with a bright white cover. You know, remember the joy of sex with the joy of science fiction, with the red splotch and that. So I think that's a great, you know, because there's the joy of cooking. I want to do the joy of limericks as well. I've done a lot of limericks, and they're sitting. Nobody wants to publish a limerick book. I'll self-publish.
There once was a fellow named Gerald.
Yeah. There once was a fellow named Gerald who was known to have happily caroled, "Oh, promise me in an A minor key as over Niagara he barreled." That was written by Diane Duane. I can't take credit for that one.
Okay.
But I want to do the joy of limericks, and then the ones that are really filthy will go into the satanic limericks. Yeah, there's somebody. Asimov and I were going to do a limerick duel, but Doubleday didn't. we don't want to hurt the brand. So, but Asimov and I were going to do a limerick book together.
Okay. One thing I will caution people again, this is radio, so I don't mind if people start asking questions, but we have to repeat them. So the listening audience at home, there is actually one, knows what they are. Or come up here.
We must respect the listeners, both of them.
Yeah.
So anyway,
Yeah,
what were we talking about before we got into? The anthology.
Yeah. Why not become an editor? I mean, that, the concept
an editor,
you just
it's
pitched.
Hard work. I've edited 5 anthologies, and I think what spoiled me for editing is the last one was called Alternities, and it
oh.
And the Clarion class, some, you know, I think Clarion is a great idea, but this one particular class at Clarion got a little arrogant about, well, we're Clarion students and we're wonderful and we know how. And so they were passing around Alternities as an example of the worst anthology ever.
The problem, we'll still have to repeat them because this is the radio mic.
All right.
And we will not hear
so, And then another fanzine trashed me that there weren't enough women authors in Alternities. And, you know, it's like I can only pick the best of the stories that crossed my desk. And in the previous 4 anthologies, I had Tiptree, I had Vonda McIntyre, I had Kathleen Skye, I had a couple women who are no longer writing. But, I was actively reaching out for women writers, and I didn't get any stories or many for Alternatives. So I was being trashed as a sexist pig because not enough women had submitted stories. And then they were, you know, this is the worst anthology ever. It's like, you know, first of all, if you're a writer, one of the things you don't want to do is piss off editors. And you don't want to say, oh, this editor doesn't know what he's doing. Yeah, because if I'd have started a 6th anthology, which I wouldn't have been, I could have done it. But Roger Elwood had flooded the market with a second-rate anthology, so the anthology market was dead, so I didn't bother. But, I had a list of all those Clarion kids. You're never going to sell to me. You know, don't piss off the editor. But I think it's the root of arrogance. If you are in a writing class, to start disparaging people who have already been in the industry 10, 15, 20 years, who have a track record, who have Hugo and Nebula nominations, who supposedly, allegedly know what they're doing, start pretending you know more than they do. And I've run into this more than once of the guy who's still in the creative writing class, you know, but he's in the advanced writing class, right? In college, explaining, you know, why you as a 25-year author or veteran don't know what you're doing. You say, excuse me, and you wanted to do the story where they find out that we find out they're really Adam and Eve at the end. When I read a book, if I'm unhappy, if I'm dissatisfied, I don't go to, oh, I know more than this writer. I go to, what did I miss? What was the ambition here? What were they trying to do? How well did they do it? Was it worth doing in the first place? So I don't go, oh, this is a crap, which is a reactive emotional judgment. And you're missing the real value. It's like, I read this, it didn't work for me. Why? And so one of the examples is Farnham's Freehold, which nobody likes. And I go to it and I say, okay, see what Heinlein was attempting. I think he fumbled. But why he fumbled is because this, I think he missed it here and here. But I can see what he was attempting. So, because I'm always, I'm approaching everything, I'm still a student. They mailed me my diploma. I didn't get to graduate, right? So, so I still feel like I'm approaching everything as a student. By the way, if you want to write, I'm going to give you the bad news. It's like 50 years of doing homework every night. And the day, too, is like, that's the bad news about writing. It's like you never got, it stopped doing homework.
It's work.
It is hard work. So, but because I still, because I still think of it like a little bit like homework, I still have that relationship, I still feel like a student. What can I learn from this? And if I read a bad book or a bad story, it's what can I learn from it? Aside from don't do this, what else can I learn from it? Because I think the biggest trap for anybody, whether you're a writer or an actor, whatever you're doing, the biggest trap is to be arrogant, because that leads you into being judgmental. And when you get judgmental, you start missing. There's information you're not getting. And I think that was, I'm going to go off, that was part of that whole Hugo kerfuffle of a couple years ago, is some people in science fiction, and it doesn't matter which side you were on, got judgmental and weren't listening to what was being said on either side.
Yeah.
And it was what we have here is a failure to communicate.
It really was. And this sort of is peripheral to that whole kerfuffle. You said that you can only publish, as an editor, you can only publish the stories that cross your desk.
Yeah.
How will science fiction, spec fic, the whole field is starting to become more inclusive, but how do we make it more inclusive, more accepting, all kinds of canines aside, angry or sad?
As an editor, what I did is I reached out to writers who I knew I could depend on, or writers who I knew were on their way up, or were eager to sell, or writers who I trusted. But I also sent letters to Tiptree and Vonda. Well, I knew Vonda, but I did a lot of invites, and that helps. Ed Bryant, I got great stories out of Ed Bryant. Mm. There's another one. That bastard had to go and die on
us.
Oh
God, yes.
Cynthia Felice called me, and I knew it was going to be bad news, so I kept her chatting about everything else. But she says, David, I called with bad news. I know, that's why I'm not keeping you chatting about everything. Oh, God, that was the worst morning. The opportunity to work with writers is really great fun. I mean, if I was going to do an anthology today, I'd pick up the phone, I'd call Keith Candido, I'd call Adam Troy Castro, Peter David, among the women writers, there's so many who are good, Nora Jemison and Kate Tempest Bradford and Charlie Jane Anderson. I want the people who are being dangerous. I don't want nice, safe, blue bunny dog stories. I want something dangerous. Although if you gave me a man-eating blue bunny dog, I would be tempted. So anyway, where were we going with that? We're talking, anthologies.
No. Well, inclusiveness.
Inclusiveness, yeah. I was on a panel at a convention over Gallifrey, a Doctor Who convention. It was about script writing. And we were talking about the history of script writing. And I looked around and I said, you realize there's only two men on the panel and there's six women? That's how far we've come from the days when D.C. Fontana had to use initials instead of the name Dorothy. Is that the majority of writers on these science fiction shows we're talking about are now women. There's Gillian, Horvath, and I don't remember the names of the other young ladies. I wouldn't invent them at that convention. But there's, and Jane Espenson and so on. So I would go to writers like that because I know they would be thinking outside the nice, safe boundaries of. I would go to Steve Barnes and to Nana Rivdu and. I'm not going to even try and pronounce the Chinese names because I'll get them wrong. I lived in China long enough to know that Guaylos like myself should not.
Ken Liu is a great gateway to other writers.
Yeah, Ken Liu, Ted Chiang, so on. By the way, Guaylo means ghost face. That's what the Chinese call. And Poke Guy means asshole. So I would say, hi, I'm the Poke Guy Guaylo, and they would laugh at me. I believe in that, is that we have, there's 7.5 billion human beings on this planet, probably 8 by now, we just haven't, it's hard to keep up, and we are not all white, we are not all straight white males, we are, in fact, there's probably at 7.5 billion different kinks and sexual orientations on the planet. So my thinking is that we have to represent the Maoris from New Zealand and the Aborigines from Australia and the Sichuan speakers in China and the Mandarin speakers in Hong Kong and all the different sects in India and all the different, you know, the Ukrainians and the Inuit and those who are, you know, we have to be aware that we are not alone on this planet, that we are not somehow the pure Nordic ideal, the Aryan ideal, everybody else is that. That's bullshit, you know. It's like, it's there is so much to learn from. I have learned so much from my study of Japanese culture, from what I can learn from the indigenous American natives. I'm not even sure what to call them anymore. I don't want to use the word Indian, but I know that they're not native. Are they? They're first Americans. All right. So the language is evolving faster than we can speak it. So, you know, we want to write about believable aliens, and we can't even write believably about other people that we share the planet with, let alone to write a believable alien. And I'll give you an example. I did this. There's a script I wrote for Trek Next Generation called Blood and Fire that they didn't shoot. We did it as a fan film for Star Trek New Voyages. And you can download it, or I have copies available on the
YouTube
table. Yeah, I have books for sale in the dealer's room. Come buy some. I don't want to take them home. We did Blood and Fire. Well, it has a gay character. It has a gay romance. It's not just one gay character. How can you be gay alone, right? You have to have somebody to be gay with, right? Anyway, so the fan community went crazy when they heard we're doing a fan film was gay. And I said, wait a minute. Gene Roddenberry promised us gay characters. We're just going to keep the promise. No. And the one that just, I fell out of my chair laughing is the fan who said, well, I believe in diversity, but it has to be normal diversity.
It's a great line.
Man, that was the one where I ripped off his head and pissed down his neck, because that was the... I had to explain to him, it's like, so it's all right with you that an Earth woman can sleep with a Vulcan man, or the captain of the Enterprise can sleep with a green skin Orion slave girl. That's all right with you. But two crewmen who are working on the Enterprise can't, you know, snuggle a little? That's not all right with you? That two humans can't do it together, but it's okay to do it with, you know, bestiality, right? So... That's alien bestiality.
Or maybe alien worstiality. There you go. That slash fiction began. Was originally
slash. Don't get me started on slash fiction. I have no problem with fanfic or even slash fiction, but some of the promulgators of it were certifiable.
Oh, yeah. we do have, at this point, we've actually gotten to the point. It's 1:20. We have about 5 minutes if we're going to allow for change. But let's, people in the audience, questions, comments, we'll have to repeat them.
Microphone.
Charlie, come up and use this mic.
Okay, but no hard questions.
You don't have to answer. And speak also sort of toward this chair. Yeah, that's yeah. Where so the radio mic is.
The radio mic needs to.
And you have to be on my show. You haven't done that yet. Jeez. This is Charlie Bochner, by the way.
Hey, Charlie.
Hey, I've long been a fan of The Man Who Folded Himself. And the thing that impressed me, at least from my reading, is it seems like a metaphor for every man going from birth to death. And I'm wondering how you wrote that at such a young age.
By accident. I did not know how to end that book. It's not exactly a metaphor from birth to death. Well, if you see it that way, it is. But it's more a metaphor for growing up. And 99% of the book is all the different possibilities and all the different choices that you have available to you in a lifetime. But the essence of the book is in the last line, which is where he says, I'm going to put on the belt, the time belt, which essentially he's saying, I accept the responsibility. The whole book is, here's all the different life choices you can make. And the last line is, I accept the responsibility. And I did not know what the last line was until I got to it. Because I was just, you know, that was a difficult book to write because I could write 3 pages and then I didn't know what happened next. And I was house-sitting for Donald Westlake. Ooh. And I was working on the War Against the Tour, and then my agent calls and says, I sold The Man Who Folded Himself. And oh, shit, I had to write it. So it was like 3 pages. And then I'd walk around the house for 3 days. And, oh, I know. 3 pages. And then I'd walk around the house for a day. And, oh, I know what I can do. And so that was a slow book to write because I did not know what was going to happen next. I kind of had an idea where it was going to end up. But the middle section... And there were a couple of places that were absolute. I cheated. I said, I'm just a leapfrog over that one. But then I got to the end, and it's like, well, how does this end? It's back at the beginning again, where he opens the box. Here's the manuscript, and he reads it. And I thought, well, if it was me, you damn right I'm going to put on the belt. I might not do everything I've just read, but I'm going to put on the belt and see what else I can do. So I said, I see. I accept the responsibility. So, yeah, I get that there is a strong metaphor in the book, but at the time, I was what, like 25 when I wrote it or something like that. And I think it was, I was working through a lot of questions of my own. Somebody very close to me had been murdered, and I was questioning the meaning of life. And so when Harley was one and The Man Who Folded Himself, both came out of those internal conversations what are we supposed to do with this mess that we call life? And said either we shoot my script or it's not available. The only other property I have where I would say either I'm an active creative control person would be The War Against the Tour. I am not going to let anybody screw that one up and turn it into, you know, Transformers or, you know.
Yeah.
Michael Bay picture.
You know where that would play well on a streaming service?
Well, I would like to do it like Game of Thrones has been done. You do 10 episodes based on book one, 10 episodes on book two. And because there's enough space there to expand each of those books. And then for those, book five, A Method for Madness, is now book five, A Nest for Nightmares, book six, A Method for Madness, and book seven, A Time for Treason. So, and that's what I've been working, is moving chapters around. Because this is what he came up with. The same way Heinlein and Vonnegut and Sturgeon and Clark have all had their answers. I want to have my answer be not just unique, but youthful. So that's the both the question and answer are the same thing there. Is what are you committed to creating and who do you have to become to create it? And it is not a... It is not a question that has an answer. It is a question that you have to keep asking yourself, I have to keep asking myself.
Well, I think that there are a whole lot of people in the world that are grateful that you became David Gerald.
No, it was a dirty job, but somebody had to do it. And it turns out nobody else can do it as well as I can. That is the one nice thing about, is that... I am the best David Gerald author there is. Nobody else can write a David Gerald story, so I have that singular uniqueness about me, and I think every author has that uniqueness.
But I wanted to add that you're beyond being an author. You have become an inspiration to people, the way that you handled the Hugos last year in a very difficult situation.
It's our family. We're going to celebrate excellence in our family, and anybody who doesn't want to be a member of our family is missing the fun.
Well, it's a family of humanity, and you have brought so much humanity to the world and taught us a lot about it, and at the same time, entertained us.
Well, yeah, me and Heinlein were competing for Joe's beer money.
There you go.
So I have books on my table in the dealer's room. This is the commercial. I have some scripts.
I will autograph his...
No, I have the Blood and Fire video of that episode, and I have the Mega Pack, which has the video of my play in it. So if anything I've said, you say, gee, I wish I could see that.
And if you are a radio listener, where can people get this?
I'm on Facebook. And there's also a Gerald.com, which we're in the process of rebuilding, but you can order stuff online from Amazon as well. So I'm not too hard to find. And if you write to me on Facebook, I can point you into directions where you can find more stuff. Or I can sell it to you myself. So, yeah, I mean, come on. I got to pay for the hotel and the Motel 6 and the gas bill to get home. Otherwise, you people are stuck with me. So,
well, on behalf of the convention, as the very first guest of honor, there'll be one tomorrow, of Heliosphere. Thank you.
Thank you all very much.
From March 11th,
scant
month ago, at Heliosphere, at the very first Heliosphere, David Gerald, author of The Trouble with Tribbles, is the thing that I think everybody will remember him for his landmark Star Trek episode. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio. Broadcasting at 99.5 FM. I am Jim Freund. I am getting ready to make room for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming your way in, but 4 minutes. And a reminder that I will be at Lunacon this coming weekend. There are now two science fiction conventions, regular science fiction conventions in New York. Heliosphere last month was one, and Lunacon, the oldest established permanent, etc., con in New York, will start on Friday. And to find out more about that, you just go to lunacon.org and look it up. I'm particularly pleased. I will not only be doing similar to what you heard there, I'll be doing the guest of honor speech or interview with Ben Bova, who I haven't seen in, like 25 years or more. But I will also be running the reading track, where writers come and read their work to you. And we're going to do that Friday, starting at 4, going to 11 p.m., and Saturday all day, and Sunday till about 4 p.m., and on Friday evening at about, 6 o'clock. I will be teaching my reading aloud for writers. Writers are allowed to read aloud. In other words, you're not a professional reader, but we will help you do that. I will help you do that. So I hope you make it to Lunacon. Look me up if you do. In the meantime, please, everybody, be good to each other, because you deserve it. We deserve it. And it's what makes the world worthwhile. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Find me on Facebook. Find me at OurWolf.com. Very old website, but we're working on it. And there's an Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook as well. I'll be back next week on Thursday morning, New York time, 1 to 3 a.m. And, with something else thoroughly exciting. Have a good week, take good care,
And, oh, yes, good Yontif. Take care.
Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran. Mexico. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah. My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag.
Not before.
That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle the Star Spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why trying to scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Great show this morning, Jim Fry, and don't forget to join Jim just before you join Lister next week, same place, same time, right here at 99.5 FM, WBAI, WBAI.org, Pacifica Radio at its very best. It's just a little herb for Jim Fry.
It's just a little herb, boy, it's just a little herb. Feeling good with all my brethren. We like to socialize. We like to feel so irate. And to ease our mental state of mind, we're smoking sensei. It's just a little herb. It's just a little herb song. It's just a little herb.
Little herb stall. It's just a little herb stall.
towards the new century, armed with the new technology. We're getting more and more productivity. Some say things looking up for prosperity. But if everyone gon' get a share this time, well, mentality must get left behind. We want the shorter working day, give it the shorter working week. Longer holiday, we need peace and fear. More time for leisure, more time for pleasure, more time for edification, more time for recreation, more time to contemplate, more time to ruminate, more time. We need more time, give it more time. A full time them abolish unemployment and revolutionize labor deployment. A full time them banish overtime. Make everybody get a work this time. We need a higher quality of liberty. We need it no one for everybody. We need the shorter working year, give it the shorter working life. More time for the husband, more time for the wife. More time for the children, more time for a friend, and more time for meditate, more time for create, more time for living, more time for life, more time. We need more time, give it more time. Century, armed with the new technology. We're getting more and more productivity. Some say things looking up for prosperity. But if everyone gon' get a share this time, well, mentality must get left behind.